I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to all of you out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network with NPR Community Voices. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and with me is my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's going really well, Brandon. And yourself?
Oh, not bad. You and I the other night were part of another very special interview. We've been lucking out lately here with some of these interviews, and we got a really, really great guest.
Yeah, lucking out is maybe putting it mildly for this one, because we had Hollywood royalty. I mean, I don't think that's underselling it either, because our guest was Todd Fisher. And if you don't know that name, you may know the name Carrie Fisher, who is was Todd's sister, unfortunately passed the end of 2016. And their mother was, also the late, Debbie Reynolds. So to say that Todd was a connected, Hollywood family is kind of underselling it. He has lots of connections into the Hollywood regimes.
Yeah. And not to mention his father was Eddie Fisher, who was a popular singer at the time. Although if you go into Todd's book, which you and I both read for this, to prepare for this interview, he wrote a book 2 years ago called My Girls as a tribute to both Carrie and Debbie. And his father, Eddie Fisher, was a very popular singer at the time, and had a lot of number one hits and stuff. But as if you read the book, you know that Todd's life is kind of defined by scandal. And we don't really go into it into the interview, because I know he's talked about it a million times. But, you know, the whole story is Eddie Fisher. Well, it all started, Elizabeth Taylor was married to actually Todd's namesake, Mike Todd, mm-hmm. who was a big impresario and film producer. Mike Todd dies in a plane crash tragically. And so Eddie Fisher goes over to comfort Elizabeth Taylor, and things happen, and Eddie leaves Debbie for Elizabeth. And that was one of the huge scandals at the time. And so
huge scandal. Debbie and Eddie were America's sweethearts, and Elizabeth Taylor was this vixen that came in and stole them away. And the book tells you a little bit more detail about that, and whether it's true or not. So,
if you read the book, you know that Eddie was never really in Todd's life that much. It affected Carrie much more than it affected Todd. Debbie was really kind of, Todd's saving grace in his life and everything, but yeah. And we had the pleasure of interviewing him at his studio in Las Vegas. And, for those of you who normally just listen to our audio podcasts, I implore you to find us on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. We will have the video posted. He interviewed us amidst a wealth of Hollywood memorabilia, and
and he sort of launches in, my fault, I said, hey, what are all these things surrounding you? So the first part of this podcast is him just picking up stuff and pointing his finger and telling us what it is. So not great listening, great viewing, entertainment, but stick with it. A couple minutes in, we get more into those stories of what his life was like.
Yeah, and you'll get to see a few things you certainly recognize. I'm not going to spoil it for you. I hope that you'll watch and you'll listen. But it's obvious that this man was very affected by the two main women in his life. As he mentions in our interview, he had a front row seat to that relationship and both of them. And the two of the biggest characters that you can imagine if you read the book and view it. You can just tell the love and admiration he has for his mother, and the love that he had for his sister, and he was very protective of his sister as well. And he goes into her dealing with bipolar disorder. There's a lot of wonderful stories he tells.
Yeah, and we touch on a lot of different things in this one, so it's a great listen.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so we're going to go into the interview right now. You can listen here in the audio, but once again, just a reminder, watch on YouTube so you can see all of the stuff that he's talking about that we might not go into great detail on the audio. So here is Todd Fisher. So, yeah, we are here with Todd Fisher. And Todd, we appreciate so much you taking the time out to talk to us today.
Well, I am happy to be here. I'm on my wide shot. I'll go close so you can see me a little better. But I like to start with the wide shot because you get to see me in my natural habitat. You know, if you guys observe wildlife in their natural habitat, in my family, this is our natural habitat. It's like a lot of equipment and artifacts. That's how we roll.
For the people that aren't seeing the video, Todd, what are a few of the things that are around you there? Because there's some that are straight out of my childhood here.
Well, it just so happens that when this whole coronavirus thing happened, we decided to do a live blog show. And so I pulled out a few things for the set that are pretty iconic. So sitting off to my left is R2-D2. Now, this R2-D2 was actually Carrie's R2-D2. It was given to her. It was not screen used, but it was made for by the same guys that made the set stuff. And this is a replica of Yoda that's sitting off to my side here. And this, in Yoda's arms right here, and I'll pull him out right now. This is before there was a baby Yoda. Carrie made this years and years and years ago. I'm not even sure what generation this was. But I actually think this is a much cuter baby Yoda. Let's see if it's got a date on it here. 07. So some point in 07, I thought, I mean, tell me that's not a great baby Yoda. Then we have, now those are, again, that's a replica. And then C-3PO's behind me. And I can probably go wide and let's get real wide here for those while I'm describing it. So C-3PO's over here. Got a carry cut out over there. But over to the other side, you've got the unsinkable Molly Brown costume. You can see it just to the left of the monitor there. That's my mother's belly up to the bar boys. Down front, on the right side, this side, is Debbie's stage costume from Vegas. Then there's Susan Slept Here, Debbie costume, which is an RKO picture that she made for Howard Hughes. And then on the far left is a Give a Girl a Break. That's Gower Champion and my mother's costume from Give a Girl a Break, a cute little musical. And you can kind of see in front of that, there's a really cool picture of Carrie and a stack of scripts. Those are like Singing in the Rain, some really high-end scripts that belong to my mom.
Wow.
And then getting into the nitty-gritty, like here's my mother's Jean Hersholt Academy Award. That's kind of a cool piece.
Wow.
And then I've got, and I can't, supposed to not grab these without these gloves. We grab the slippers with the gloves. But we've got my mother's pair of the ruby slippers that she acquired through MGM.
Wow. And those are amazing. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Wow.
Everybody loves the ruby slippers, but I hate to touch them because pretty old. And the sequins are really old and they get brittle, you know. Now, then another cool item here is I've got Carrie's blaster. It's hard to see in this lighting. Let me get it on some background here. Here we go. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. From the Star Wars, that's from the original Star Wars movie.
Yeah, so I have two of these. This one doesn't actually fire, but I actually have another one that really actually fires a blank.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And then I have a little, this was Carrie's lightsaber that was given to her that probably would have been used in the last film that just was finished. But they made this for her and gave it to her, and it never got screen used because Carrie... Well, there's a place where Carrie is using a saber, I guess, in Return of the Jedi. But bottom line was she didn't get a chance to become the fearless saber warrior.
Sure.
Let's see what else is around me here. There's Carrie's director's chair from Empire over there. You got mine and my mother's and Kat's director's chairs up here. Oh, here's a little ditty. There's the nomination certificate for the Unsinkable Molly Brown for an Academy Award of my mom's. That happens to be hanging around. I guess anything that's here might have been something we were talking about. And I've got some, but I do have other things down there. So if we, as we're moving along, I can hit you with, bring a few items into play.
Yeah. Well, Todd, I've noticed, I read your book that came out a couple of years ago, My Girls, and I can't believe all the different hats you've worn over the years, you know, from producer, director, minister, and collector and curator. Of course, you're obviously showing us. Is there one hat that you wear that sort of seems to take precedence over all the others?
Well, I think I had on the designated driver hat more than the other hat. I always considered myself sort of the guy that was trying to keep the family on the rails. As you know, Carrie was pretty infamous from, I mean, she didn't even care that she was off the rails. So like some people know they're off the rails, she didn't even care. So it was at times I'd have to step in and say, hey, we need to get back over here, get on the rails. My mom was in trouble a lot with her marriages and things. So starting at a young age, I became involved in rescuing and becoming the designated driver. Now, as the designated driver, you do need, within that hat is a lot of hats, not the least of which is preserving this collection that my mother was so passionate about. And, you know, she tried to instill a certain sense of duty to Carrie and I at a very young age of the importance of preserving this history of Hollywood. We had grown up on the back lots of MGM and 20th Century Fox, and we had a certain appreciation, but we also sort of took it for granted because it was our backyard and we were used to seeing these people, and we didn't really understand how important they were to the public and to history. And so when the MGM studios decided they were going to sell off everything, my mother went into a panic. And we didn't understand it. My sister and I were looking at her. We were in our teens, and we were like, you know, why are you panicking about this? And she was like, I have to preserve this stuff at all costs. We didn't fully understand it. We went to the auctions with her. I got into it a little. I started collecting cameras and weapons and certain things that I thought were cool for a teenager. But she, at the same, you know, was preserving serious stuff like the subway dress, all the way from the suit of lights of Tyrone Powers and Charlie Chaplin's outfits and Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, you know, both Cleopatras, Claudia Colbert and also the Liz Taylor and all three Mutiny on the Bounties. And just, you know, it became vast and it became a magnificent obsession. And she passed that down to my sister and I. Now, some people call us high-end hoarders, but it's, you know, it's classy stuff, you know, so it's not a bad thing to be called.
Todd, where do you think that came from her? What drove her to want to preserve those things? How did she see it when no one else did?
Real simple. She was a fan. She grew up, you know, very young in life during the Depression, came out to my grandfather worked for the Southern Pacific Railroad. And he came from El Paso, Texas to a job in Burbank, which was nothing at the time. And she was just going to John Burroughs High in Burbank, and she was a baton twirler majorette and was very athletic and wanted to be a gym teacher, but she didn't know she was going to get discovered when she went to the Miss Burbank contest. But before all that, she's paying 10 cents to go to the movies. She loved these people. She knew Katharine Hepburn and Betty Davis, grew up with all these people, and Gary Cooper and Clark Gable. She grew up with these people. And, you know, she was a student of film, even at a very young age, because she went to the movies all the time. She knew obscure movies. And when Carrie and I were growing up, we were brought up every Wednesday night on a classic film that she chose. We could pick Saturday night and have another film, and then our friends could come and all that. But Wednesday night was her pick. And you know, you're running Now Voyager with Betty Davis, and she's afterwards, there's a Q&A. So it was before Turner Classic Movies was Debbie Classic Movies. So that was her passion. She was a fan who became a star, and a star that became a collector. That's a nice combination.
Yeah, absolutely. And she never took any of it for granted, it sounds like, too. She always kept that appreciation of what had been given to her. That's
for
great.
Sure. She never took, she was always a girl, little girl from Burbank, you know, and really was very relatable to the people. You know, she used to come down to the audience in Vegas or when she would tour and get with the people. And they really connected with her because she's one of them. She's not, as much as she is a movie star or even a diva, she's also one of the people and was very connected with her fans for 7 decades.
Yeah. When you were growing up, was there an awareness that this was an unusual childhood, or was it just normal to you?
Yeah, I've been asked that question a lot, but you can imagine that our sense of reality is only what our sense of reality is. So we grew up in this huge, huge palace. Carrie used to call the house the mausoleum, because from the outside, it literally looks like a temple, a Jewish temple. And it's a super modern and huge house. And of course, we grew up around all these celebrities, and we used to go to all the movie sets and hang out on the sets and meet all these amazing people. I mean, I've met everybody. I mean, somebody my age who could say I've met Charlie Chaplin, or I've met, you know, Norman Rockwell. I mean, you know, we got to meet some pretty cool people in our time because of her. I watched Leave It to Beaver, you know, and I thought, well, shoot, that doesn't look like anything that I recognize. Or, you know, so we saw whatever. There were a lot of people that grew up like that. That represented a certain thing that was happening in the 60s and 70s. And I certainly didn't recognize that for me, but it was our sense of reality. Carrie says in the HBO documentary Bright Light, she says, my brother and I shared a growing up in a strange environment of weirdness. Now, that's her take. That's not my take. But it shows you how she thought it was weird. Even later in life, she's talking at that point when she's in her late 50s, and I never saw it as weird. To me, it was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes that you say in the book was you and your sister having different views on how your childhood went, and your mom saying that she had the films to prove that it was a happy childhood.
Yeah. My mother used to do that all the time to Carrie. Now, Carrie would constantly, especially later in life when you get into analysis, she would constantly come back with that typical, you know, I had an unhappy childhood. Now, I was like, what are you talking about? Now, I wouldn't say anything because it didn't mean anything to me. So I never rebutted that. My mother, though, took it personal. And she's like, wait a minute. I have films to prove that you had a happy childhood. You know, and she did. Now, she had something better than that. She had me. That was always a
witness for the prosecution.
That was a problem for Carrie. There was a live witness that it was there all the time, that experienced everything the same, but experienced it differently. Now, at the time when all this is going on, we don't know Carrie is bipolar. So a lot of her take on things was always different, and we didn't get it until much later on. So some of that explained a lot of our earlier observations and why she saw things so differently, because partly that's what made Carrie so brilliant, was that she did have bipolar and she saw the world so differently and experienced everything so differently. You could do something with Carrie, and when you were done, she could tell what just happened, and you'd be like, wow, was I there? I mean, like, you know, that's an amazing, you know, that's how different she saw things, even as simple as just a day-to-day experience.
So she saw a competition between her and her mother and your mother. Did your mom see it that way? Did you see that from your mom?
No, I mean, the best, you know, that went on for a long time. And I've heard that, of course, for decades. And it's true. Carrie did felt a competition, felt a need. Who could be as pretty as talented as funny as, who could dance as well as, who could sing as well as? I mean, it's a monumental thing to try to compare yourself to. So I never even thought about trying to. It was like, whatever. But because she was going into the show business the way she was, she did see it as a competition. My mother never did. Richard Dreyfuss and I did a Q&A at the Chinese Theater, the TCL Chinese Theater, not that long ago. And I didn't know this, but Richard was the first one I'd ever heard tell a story from his vantage point. And he said, there was no competition there. Only Carrie was involved in this competition. Debbie wasn't competing. So he was a relatively an outsider of sorts, even though he's a friend of the family. He was still an outsider that saw very clearly regardless of what Carrie was saying, that that was truly a one-sided competition. Personally, I never saw any competition. I people used to say, what is it like being in the shadow of this great movie star? And I was like, nah, I like the shade.
And you sort of chose to be there, right? You elected to move to the other side of the camera and be on more of a production, a cinematography type of things. How did that love come about?
So when I was really young, my mother had Carrie and I in her Vegas act. And, you know, we were playing Vegas and I had to play guitar, put on makeup and do a lot of things, do shows in Vegas. When you're a young guy, you know, you want to be out doing other things. I was not enamored with that. And she had us also do some television shows with her. And I played a couple of parts. And I remember arriving on the set where I knew a lot of these people. These are crew people that we've known our whole life. And at this point, I'm like 11. You know, and they herd you off to a trailer where there's a teacher and now you have to study your lines for this and you also still do your schoolwork. And I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing all my friends that are setting up sets and cameras and lights and, you know, really working on the creative engineering of what makes a film what it is. Mm-hmm. And I had this epiphany that I didn't want to be in that trailer. I didn't want to, and actresses and actors are, whether you realize it or not, very much set aside until needed, like any other tool. They're sure. Then brought in to execute a certain discipline on the set, and then they're put away. They no longer are welcome even on the set. If you saw an actor like bugging a director, he'd be like, you know, go to your trailer. I mean, you know, I'm working on the movie. So not always, but you know, that you are just a tool. And I saw that pretty young and I was like, nope, I'm not doing that. I want to be involved on the creative side.
And it's served you and your mother well all those years because, you know, you got to really take that ride alongside her in all of her various projects.
I did. And Carrie too. We all did things together and had a lot of fun. I had a television series on back in the early 80s called Nightlight. And it was like a Saturday Night Live. And at that time, Carrie was dating Dan Aykroyd. And, you know, so I had her and Danny and my mother and all kinds of people that I knew were on the show with me. And I didn't mind in that environment doing some acting because I was playing with my friends, but I directed and produced that. But I remember when they asked me to do this show, I decided I was going to star in it, produce it, and direct it. And the reason why I thought that was no problem is I saw like Clint Eastwood and Robert Redford. And so I thought, huh, this is nothing. This is no big deal. It's a big deal. I found myself one day showing up to the set. I said, okay, what's next? And it was my scene and I was unprepared to do my bit. And I was like, well, you're fired. Oh, wait a minute. You know, I mean, seriously, yeah. It's like, it's so hard to be focused on producing and directing a show. And then at the same time, you know, step out of that role and go right into the role that you're playing. I got to tell you, you got to give them a tremendous amount of respect for people that can do all three things. Triple threat in that world is truly that, directing, producing, and acting. It's amazing when they can do all that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing these days, because you're still involved in production, and I've noticed from your website, you've got a mobile production unit. So tell us a little bit about what's going on with your studio and those types of things.
Well, a while ago, many years ago, we built a studio in California, my family, and we had a tremendous amount of work that we could bring away from LA and work up in the San Luis Obispo area. And so we had started to get used to doing production work as much as possible away from LA in a nicer, better environment. And my mother always loved Vegas. She'd been a Nevada resident, you know, since the 60s, really. And so she was always working here. But it wasn't until California got, a simple way to say it is that over the years, the monkeys have gotten in charge of the bananas. And the state is a disaster in the business sense. And it's a beautiful, look, I love it. I was born there. I was brought up in California. I still own homes there. I love it. But it is a disaster when it comes to being a business person there. And running a studio in that environment is really complicated and very difficult. The labor laws, all these things. So we decided as we got a little older, we would move all of that operation to Vegas as in an attempt to simplify, because the environment here for business is much better. No corporate income tax, things like that. So they just and they love Debbie. Always sure, loved Debbie sure. here. And they loved Carrie and I because we were part of Debbie. You know, we were connected to all of that. And so I moved a large portion of the studio here, and I moved a mobile recording truck here, which is one of the only 4K cinema trucks anywhere. A lot of these mobile trucks you see are gigantic. This is sort of made movie style, but it can do concerts and things too, but all at very, very high resolution. We even have new 12K cameras. You know, for cinema projects, but I collect classic lenses. The way my mother was collecting costumes and things, I collected the lenses that made the movies. I collected the cameras that made the movies. Now, as it turns out, those lenses are still very usable. So I have one of the largest privately owned collections of lenses, and I have the lenses made, say, Casablanca and wow. Maltese Falcon. I have the lenses that did Citizen Kane. Now, those Citizen Kane lenses are actually going to be loaned to the Academy for their big opening, because they're doing a piece on Citizen Kane. So I'm loaning them the lenses for that. But I have the Godfather lenses, which are some of my favorite lenses to still use today. So a lot of these lenses can really give you a certain look, a very, very special look that can only be made that way. Today, a lot of things are done with plugins and After Effects and things like that. But you can't simulate what a piece of glass gives you. Harry Stradling Sr. taught me a long time ago that the eye of the camera is everything. It's the lens. It's the eye of the camera. That is what is ultimately, whatever's there is there, and what's not there is not there. Now, you can mess around with certain things, but the lens is everything. So I have an amazing collection of lenses. And that, you know, I have to believe that came from my mother. It was sort of my interest, within her passion became my passion. And I have Charlie Chaplin's camera, for an example, that came from SNA Studios out of Chicago that they used to lure him away, from the other studios that he was working with at the time. Max Sennett was where he was, and then SNA Studios stole him. And the part way they did that was with this camera, which was state of the art at the time. And so, you know, he was a techie. Chaplin was a techie.
So they used that as a lure. They said, hey, look, we've got this new toy that we can let you make movies with.
One of the first Bell & Howell 2709s to come out of the Bell & Howell factory was the one that they got and literally lured Chaplin in. Because it wasn't just about money with Chaplin. If you know his history at all, you'll see he was very involved in every aspect of the filmmaking. And so isn't just as important as everything else. He recognized the importance of the things we're talking about, in particular the camera. And that camera was light years ahead of everything else. So they grabbed that camera, and that was literally, I have the original order sheet. I think it was the 17th one that came out of the factory. So, and then I also have the first Mitchell that came off the line, Mitchell Standard, that was used on Casablanca, Maltese Falcon, and things like that. So I have an interest in that, because to me, those are things that defined filmmaking in so many ways. So I love the pieces of equipment that help make that magic. It's not one thing or another what makes a movie. You know, it takes a lot of things to make a brilliant movie. And so it's nice when you have you can bring all those pieces back together and even play with them. I mean, I've used these lenses, you know, and that's pretty cool. I shot some wide angle. Like, I have Stanley Kubrick's lens that shot The Shining and things like that. Oh, I just used it recently on a Raiders commercial here in Vegas. And it was the only lens on Earth that could get this shot that we wanted. And there it is.
Wow. When your mom was amassing her collection, and that started around 1970, I believe, right?
Yes.
As she began amassing the collection, what did that entail? Did you all have to, I'm sure it took many warehouses to store all of that. How did,
it didn't start that way. As you can imagine, nobody really figured that out. You know, first of all, nobody knew what she was going to do, not even her. But when she got there, her hand just kept going up. You know, wow. And she's, oh my God, Romeo and Juliet, Leslie Howard, Norma Shearer, I have to have that. Oh my God. It's just like everything is an oh my God. Marie Antoinette, oh, I've got to have all of that. Oh my, I have Tower and Power. And then, you know, I mean, just, you know, there's no end to it, you know, at a certain point. And literally that's what happened. So the house, we had a huge house and there was a giant rehearsal room under part of the house. It was very large, maybe 1500 square feet. That thing started filling up with racks of clothing and props and things. Pretty soon she wasn't satisfied with the costumes. She started thinking, well, you know, if we had the whole set, like from a scene, like the furniture and the props, and, you know, pretty soon we had all that stuff. And so we started getting into, that's when you start getting into outside storage. Now, over the years, we built warehouses and storage places, one in Vegas and one in up Northern California there. And, you know, we were able to handle it internally over many years. That was partly my doing because the storage costs were killing us.
Oh, no.
You know, and some of this stuff wasn't worth a lot. I mean, I'll give you a great example of something at the time people didn't understand at all. She's collecting the Nicholas brothers and Lena Horne and you know, and all these people, which were not giant movie stars. I mean, I understand, Debbie, you collect Marilyn Monroe and Clark Gable or whatever, and you have the Gone with the Wind thing, and but I don't really understand the Nicholas brothers, or I don't really understand these lesser things. She saw the importance of that. You know, she saw the importance of these smaller things. She knew there was an importance to that. I'm sitting right over here across from me is Bob Fosse's outfit and from My Sister Eileen. I mean, there's no Bob Fosse costumes that survived. It wasn't for my mother to be. There is no Bob Fosse.
Wow.
Why is Bob Fosse important? Well, Bob Fosse in his youth was dancing with my mother in all these movies, including Give a Girl a Break over there with Gower. He's in that. He's in The Affairs of Dobie Gillis. And then he goes on to become this amazing choreographer, director, you know, makes Sweet Charity. You know, I don't need to do a history on Bob Fosse, but to me, those guys are, their history is important, you know, and only Debbie saw it. I mean, it was like nobody was looking at that stuff. I mean, who's buying a Bob Fosse at auction in 1970, you know, a right. suit? It's irrelevant. Yeah, okay, she bought the Singing in the Rain stuff. I get it. You know, Molly Brown. But I don't see that stuff. So, you know, she had things that nobody understood. She had a vision to preserve the industry at its entirety and all of the things that made it great. Ironically, many, many years later, she was given the Costumers Designer Guild's Presidential Award. And we were at that event. And at the beginning, they ran a montage of all the great costumes that they had, that they thought were important. I didn't realize that they didn't make that for her because she had like 90% of those costumes.
Wow.
You know, they didn't understand it. The Academy never got it for decades. Now they get it. But for decades, they didn't understand any of the importance of preserving any of this. We had every single film that was nominated or had won for best costume design or production design, because before there was costume design, you had to win for production design. From the beginning of the creation of the Academy, every single film had been rounded up and represented by something, prop or a costume or something. And that was remarkable, and it took her life to do it, her entire life. So you asked about what that was like. It was all around us for a while, and then it eventually started to get put into warehouses. But it was never in her room. It was never like this on the set. She bought it for all of us. She preserved it for us, not for the house, not for her personal collection. She never had one costume in our house on display. Not one, ever. I do. She doesn't. When she sold her collection finally, much later in the 2000s, it was hard on her. You know, she didn't want to do it, but she knew that it wasn't happening. The Academy had turned her down again for the fifth time and on and on and on. And she was alone. It's kind of like, she was like John the Baptist, you know, a lone voice crying in the wilderness. Nobody was hearing her, or few. People did, but few. There were some supporters, Liz Taylor, you know, Roddy McDowell. I mean, there were some cool people that always supported her, Jack Haley Jr., et cetera. But she, you know, just at some point gave up. And then this auction occurred and she made a ton of money and everybody was like, wow, Debbie, you're a genius. They even did a story on her in Forbes. I mean, you think about this. She paid $1,000 for the Marilyn Monroe subway dress and sold it for $6.2 million. You know, she's a genius, right?
Yeah.
She didn't care. That wasn't what it was about for her. And so this auction had occurred, but I decided to keep all Debbie's stuff. I took the things that I kept, my cameras, and I sold some things of mine, but generally I kept the things that mattered to me. I kept all the Debbie costumes. My mother said, "Why are you keeping all of my costumes? We should sell them now. You get a great price for them." And I said, "Nah, I'm not really into that." "Well, what are you going to do with them? I mean, come on. Are you going to wear them? What are you going to do with them?" You know, I was like, I said, "I don't know what I'm going to do with them, but here they are, you know, right now around me. And I have some in my house, and I've loaned them to museums and different things. Sooner or later, you know, we'll do something with them, because they're beautifully preserved. If it wasn't for her and her spending every penny she made preserving and collecting, it wouldn't be. Just most of it would have been disintegrated through time."
Yeah.
Now Carrie was a collector also, but of more unusual things, right?
Yeah. Well, so Carrie's collection, she wasn't going to collect what my mother collected. There was no point. Nobody could compete with that. So Carrie, it was very eclectic. She collected like little weird bottles and boxes of especially medical bottles, or things that were off color, you know, things that had, black today stuff that, because you're completely inappropriate. But she found that whole history fascinating of how black people were used for advertising. She had a whole collection of that. She had a whole collection of different types of furniture that she like modern, right over here would be a super modern piece, and over here would be a Biermeister, you know, classical piece of furniture. Just the most eclectic thing. She collected paintings of these monkeys and animals. And then her most famous thing, of course, that we put in bright lights, was the collection of ugly babies. So these are high-end paintings that rich people had painting of their children that were pretty ugly. And she would search the world for ugly baby paintings. These are oil paintings painted by really good people. And the last thing that my mother and I had purchased for Carrie at an auction was a fantastic ugly baby picture with a really cool story to it. It was sitting waiting for her to get home, and she never was able to receive that gift. But that painting sits on the wall with the others to this day. So she knows it's there.
Excellent. So being in production now, what's in the middle of a pandemic, what do you think the state of the industry is right now? Are people still working? What do we need to do to keep things moving along?
There's a problem here, which is that you can't have too many people in one spot, and movies are a very collaborative thing, and people touch and interact. It's really tough. The unions are trying to deal with it. There's certain things in production right now, but largely everybody is out of work. I'm doing things. I'm friends with the people that run the Raiders, and, you know, we're doing stuff for the Raiders, and we're doing stuff for other, smaller productions. We're doing a documentary right now called De-Escalation about the current situation with the police. And, we can continue to do our work because it doesn't require mass amounts of people. Like, but even when we did the Raiders commercials here, we had to strip the crew down and act a certain way. We couldn't get permits to go in places. It's a very difficult time. As my mother used to like to say, I feel that these are her words to make us all feel better. "This too shall pass." I think she was talking about gas, but I think this will pass eventually, but it is a serious inhibiting factor to the creative process of filmmaking at large. However, it's also spawned, as you could see, a lot of underground stuff and a lot of YouTube stuff. And so if you want to look at the bright side, is we've turned millions of people loose with these cameras. And believe it or not, this camera, I did a TEDx speech, and in my TEDx speech, I have Charlie Chaplin's camera sitting next to me. And then I say, this camera blows away this camera. Mm-hmm. Imagine what Charlie Chaplin could have done with this, given the chance. Imagine what you can do just with this. My friend Roy Wagner, who's the director of photography, we're both trained by Harry Stradling Sr. He was the original cinematographer on Nightmare on Elm Street, and they reshot a whole scene in Nightmare, a whole section of Nightmare on Elm Street with the original crew on an iPhone.
Wow. Wow.
And I think the exercise is that you now have millions of potential filmmakers out there that can tell their story. So are we telling stories exactly the same way? Like we used to make even the short form movies that we used to make at the studios, you know, we had a definite three-act segment to them, and they were followed certain traditional rules. And I do like that. I still like that method of storytelling, but I'm all for turning a bunch of new filmmakers loose with these little iPhones and inexpensive editing systems. And I'm loving what we're getting out of this. So if you want to look at the bright side, yes, the big stuff is shut down. So you're not making Spider-Man 12. Like who cares?
Right. Do we need a Spider-Man 12 at this point? Yeah.
There are people that are huge Spider-Man fans, and so they care. But I don't really care about seeing another Spider-Man film. You know, I'm more interested in new stories that can be told. And there are some great stuff. Did you see, I forgot the name of the movie, but the last Burt Reynolds movie he made, it was like the last movie star or whatever it's called. It's a film that he made. It's a very low budget film that he made. It's a brilliant little movie, and he's brilliant in it. It's the last movie he made. And it's a very low budget film on a small crew. There are lots of good movies being made now in this environment. So all it does, you know, one thing Americans are great at is adversity. There's a scene in the movie Starman where Jeff Bridges is talking and as the alien, and he says, "You know what I find most amazing about you," meaning you people, you human beings. And the girl says, "No, what?" He says, "When things are at their worst, you are at your best." Isn't that true of Americans? Mm-hmm. Maybe true of other nationalities. True. I'm not an expert on every nationality, but I know it's true of us. And I see us, you know, adapting. And that's, and so when you say what happened is horrific. I have so many friends out of work. It's not even funny. I mean, it's psychedelic, like Sure. Hard to imagine. And some of them are losing their homes and all that stuff that goes with it. But there's a silver lining, which is there's a lot of other art being created. We don't stop just because there's a pandemic. We don't stop. My wife and I are in, you know, at 6:30, we're doing a live blog show here on this set. And we have a ton of fun. She does all these giveaways and we raise money for charity. And we tell stories like I'm doing now. We tell Hollywood stories. I should have a sign that says Hollywood stories, you know, told here, like a shingle. Because I do have an endless amount. In fact, when I wrote that book, My Girls, I thought, oh, this is a good thing. I'll get it all out, you know, put this whole thing to rest. It'll be very, you know, cathartic, and I'll feel much better when it's all done. Well, as I got into it, I'm like halfway done. I got 400 and some pages. By the time I was done to 800 pages, you know, all I can put out is 400 pages, which is still a lot of pages, but I couldn't tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you guys a little, I won't say too much about it, but we're going to turn that into a series, the whole My Girls book and beyond. Great. Because the My Girls book does cover sort of front to back about Carrie, Debbie, and I growing up in our lives, kind of around Debbie, ending kind of with the end of the end. But the series would get into great detail of the golden era, and it would get into more detail about Vegas and the mafia in Vegas, and how there was a guy named Sidney Korshak in Las Vegas who was sort of the consigliere to Las Vegas and Hollywood. He was the Robert Duvall character in The Godfather. He was the consigliere. So my mother dealt with those people all the time. She loved working for the mafia. And everybody's like, "Debbie, how can you say that? You know, knowing they're bad." She goes, their check never bounces. The basic stuff, you know.
They also had a code that they lived by. You know, there were a lot of business dealings you describe in that book that went south because she trusted somebody who told her something and they just weren't true to their word.
Yeah, so that's the problem with the outsiders. You know, she used to say her picker is broken when it comes to husbands, and that was certainly true. But also, you know, she had bad experiences with business people through the years. Her instincts were always brilliant. Every piece of real estate she ever bought went up in value wildly. The instinct to preserve Hollywood was more of a, beyond a righteous thing. It was also a brilliant thing. And so she had brilliant instincts. She was a great businesswoman. You know, DR Studios was operated for over four decades in Los Angeles, the Debbie Reynolds Dance Studio. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a brilliant idea. And it was something that she was passionate about giving back because she was given that chance. There's no more studio system where you're going to go become Miss Burbank and then get a contract to do a scene with Danny Kaye at Warner Brothers and then do a couple small pictures with Fred Astaire and Red Skelton and some other people. And then your contract gets picked up at MGM because someone sees you over there. And then you go on to make these MGM movies very quickly. You're making Singing in the Rain. I mean, that is a rare flow of going from nowhere to somewhere. Sure, and it doesn't happen like that. That is not there. The studio system does not train people anymore. You're on your own. But with my mother, they saw a rough piece of clay and they honed it. Gene Kelly didn't want Debbie Reynolds for Singing in the Rain. Louie Mayer said, no, I want her trained. She's your co-star. No, I want a dancer. He looked at my mother. Do you dance? She's like, well, I, you know, a little bit. He's like, what are you kidding me? You can dance with Donald and I? This is ridiculous. No, and he said, well, then you train her. Fix it. You know, and that's not going to happen today. Today, you better figure it out for your own. Now, there is, believe it or not, it's not in our face as much as it could be, but there's a ton of talent. Broadway, you know, is shut down. Broadway is full of triple threat talent. There is a lot of talent. You know, I was at the Telluride Film Festival a few years ago, and Carrie and I were there together with Bright Lights, and somebody walked up to me, and they were screening, you know, La La Land, and they walked up to me after, and I'd seen the screening, and they said, oh, that wasn't that a great little film? And I said, yeah, that was a fun little film. Yeah, for sure. And they were like, it's kind of like Singing in the Rain. I went, yikes. No, that's not like Singing in the Rain. And well, what do you mean? I said, I don't even know where to start. I mean, I could just tell you that Gosling is no Gene Kelly or Donald. Like, where do you want me to go with this? Yeah. I mean, I'm not putting him down. He's not trying to be either. But I'm just saying it's not Singing in the Rain. We need Singing in the Rain. You know, we not only the one that was made, we need new musicals. Musicals are wonderful things. Music is a wonderful thing. When I was growing up, you know, I grew up with the musical generation. I knew Irving Berlin, and I grew up around that great lyric music. Today, you know, I'm not real thrilled with rap music. What can I tell you? That's not my idea of music. It's a beat. You know, you have DJs playing beats, and that is somehow being pawned off as music. I don't see it that way. You know, now, I mean, I grew up with the rock and roll as well. I mean, that was my business as well. I loved the music industry. But again, there were actual verses and choruses and lyrics and instruments that you could recognize. So, you know, it might not be a popular thing to say, but that's just how I feel. Isn't that nice, though? We live in a country where that I can have that opinion. I can respect it. People that love other kinds of music.
Sure.
This is what's missing right now is tolerance for different points of view. It's not important that everybody love the same kind of music or the same kind of movies. That's why it's great to have millions of movies.
That's yeah, why absolutely. It's great
to have, right? You know, let people go out and make their movies like this. There are people that love that reality stuff. There's other people that want a classically well-made movie. There's people that love comic book movies like the Spider-Man thing. Not my thing, but it's great that we're making that stuff. So it's a little different strokes for different folks. And what's great about this country is that we can have that environment to have all of that stuff. We just need to be a little more tolerant of each other's differences. Today is not exactly the most tolerant of moments, at least in my, I've been on this planet a long time. I was in LA for the Watts riots, and I've been through a lot. So I've seen a lot in this movie business has gone through a lot, but it's always survived. I talked to my great grandmother about what was the movie industry like during the Depression, you know, and it thrived. Be quiet. because people wanted entertainment. They wanted to escape and get into some other perspective, some other point of view. They wanted another inspiring story. Why do you think Hollywood always had a happy ending? That wasn't because of some stupid thing. That was because people wanted to feel good when they left a movie. And nobody really wanted to be burned out or blown away. Like, oh my God. I remember when Carrie and I went to see Apocalypse Now when we were teenagers, and we walked away from that movie going, wow. I mean, we were blown away. It's an important piece of filmmaking. I have one of the cameras that made the movie. And for a while, I had Duvall's outfit and hat. Now, that's one thing I sold in the auction. But so it was important to me culturally. But it was also far from a happy ending.
Sure, right. Sure.
You can't always have happy endings, but I sure like them.
Oh, yeah.
But the movies have always reflected the zeitgeist of the time. So it is going to be interesting to see what comes in the next few years as we can begin to tell the stories of, you know, these 2016 to 2020 sort of times that we're living in.
I'm a little afraid. I'm not going to think the worst of this, but I'm a little afraid that because of all this political correctness, that it will restrict art. I think that some of this political correctness, for lack of a better word, you know, people trying to do everything just right. You don't want to say certain. If you a comedian, how does a comedian even be funny anymore? Don Rickles, I mean, was one of the funniest guys ever. But my goodness, you could be more. He couldn't even work today. So you know, we got to get over that because you know you restrict art. What makes America great is that it has the First Amendment, and you're able to say anything you want. Even if you're a communist or a Nazi, it doesn't matter. The rest of us are here to judge it or watch the show. But it is important to preserve all viewpoints at all times. And to restrict any one viewpoint in filmmaking is a crisis, because you can no longer, like the Academy was going to adopt these absurd new rules where you had a certain amount of, you know, blend of people. I mean, like by the time you're done figuring out the rules, where's you forgot the story? I mean, you know, like, wait a minute, the script doesn't fit that. The story, the script is everything, right? You hand the story, you hand the script to Katharine Hepburn and Ernest Borgnine and Debbie Reynolds, and they make a little movie called The Catered Affair. And it's brilliant, and the acting is brilliant. It's a simple little story, and it's brilliant to watch, and it's inspiring, and it's got a great message. And you can't do that if all the players, and you have to conform to some absurd storytelling rules. Storytelling should not have rules, in my opinion. You know, I'm not short on opinions.
Is that your favorite film of your mother's, The Catered Affair?
That's one of my favorites.
One of your
The Catered Affair, yeah. Is where she made the film with Betty Davis. That's when she really, she had made an earlier movie with Betty Davis, but this was one really one-on-one. She was, I think it was one of my mother's best dramatic roles. Not a musical, you know, Molly Brown's great, of course, but that's a musical drama. It's different, really a different genre in many ways. This was straight drama with Ernest Borgnine and it's Rod Taylor, Ernest Borgnine, Betty Davis. It's really good. I mean, my mother made some really good films. She was thrown into, like, I just watched a movie called Say One for Me with Bing Crosby and my mother. And of course, her heartthrob, Robert Wagner. And I was watching this movie with a different light because I haven't seen the movie in many years. Long before she passed. Now, my mother left me a message at the end of my book for Robert Wagner. If you read the book, you saw me say she always loved him. So I delivered that message in my book. But watching this movie and the two of them together in a romantic role, I mean, it's on fire. You know, when people say, wow, they have screen chemistry. You know, obviously when you're doing a film, it's a disaster when your leading people don't have chemistry. Well, whew, you know, this thing's on fire. There's some stuff that goes on in this movie that's even cinematically really brilliant, where literally there's looks are done where they block the face and you just see the eyes. Isn't that nice? you know, there's the thing in filmmaking where, or the old expression, picture says a thousand words. Well, in filmmaking, you say, let it breathe, let the actor have the moment, let the scene, no words, just let the moment happen. And here's just a set of eyes, and it just says it all. It's brilliant filmmaking, and it's great storytelling, and it's just a great romance. And Bing Crosby and her sing a duet that's cute as it can possibly be. And he, of course, is older in life. He's playing the priest, the going my way thing again.
Yeah.
And anyway, I just happened to watch that the other night. She's really, really, it's a drama role. It's sort of a, what do you call it? Romantic comedy, I guess. It's not really funny though, now that I think about it. But,
All right. I'll put you on the spot then for one other one. You don't have to give us your favorite, but what's the piece of art that Carrie made that really speaks to you?
Well, I think I'm most connected to Postcards from the Edge because I so intimately was involved in that. And I was there when we even came up with the name Postcards from the Edge. We were in China together at the Great Wall, and she was writing postcards to her friends. And she said, I'm writing to you from the edge of the world. And I'm writing you a postcard from the edge of the world and the Great Wall of China. And it was like, wow, that'd make a good title for the book I'm working on. And then the book becomes a script. And that movie, is a snapshot of my life, even though it's the names are changed to protect the innocent. There's a lot of reality in there. No, my mother didn't make milkshakes with vodka, but there's a lot of other stuff that's true in there that's remarkable. It's a really great piece of art. So I don't know, but I will tell you this. At the very end, the last Star Wars, I think it's some of Carrie's best work. I mean, it's not the newest one where they took the excerpts. That's fine. That is obviously her work, but the one prior. It's remarkable. She's got a depth to her. At this moment in time, she has become one and has settled with the idea that she and Princess Leia are one. It's a remarkable thing that happened to her. She didn't almost resented it. These actors, all of them were like, wow. Enough with the Star Wars thing. I don't want to be typecast as one of these, forever.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like she had become very settled with that idea, and her fans, gravitated to her, and they were the same. She and Princess Leia were one. It didn't matter. The things that Princess Leia stood up for, the strength and the things that she represented, were the things that Carrie was. George Lucas started the whole thing years before, 1976. Carrie walks into a room to do a screen test, and she reads that line, I'd recognize your foul stench anywhere. And, that princess attitude that she had, George saw it immediately and said, there's the princess. Now, what he didn't understand at that moment, he took advantage of it, but was that Debbie had created the princess. Carrie had been groomed, in effect, to be a Beverly Hills princess. I watched the show, So when she walked in the room and acted like a princess, she wasn't even acting. She was just doing her thing. If you had gotten in Carrie's face at any given time, she would have given you shit.
That's great.
Somebody said to me one time, they were like, what about this whole Harvey Weinstein thing, and Carrie, and how would she have responded to the Me Too movement? And I said, well, I don't know exactly how she'd respond to the Me Too movement. No one wants to be taken advantage of, but I'll tell you a story that has to deal with the Me Too movement. It's very simple. So Carrie was, essentially approached by Harvey Weinstein in a sexual fashion. She said, take your little blank into the other room and do what you have to do, but leave me alone. And so, he became pretty small and your short Jewish self and get out of here. He put him back in the box. Now that same, shortly thereafter, he did the same thing to a good friend of Carrie's who called Carrie and said what had happened. And she was like an up and coming. See, Carrie could tell him to go take a hike because she didn't need the work. We didn't need the money, whatever. She was like, get lost. This other girl was like intimidated. So Carrie sent Harvey in the mail a dead fish wrapped in newspaper, a nice big Sicilian message from the Godfather. And it said, if you don't leave my friend alone, I know a lot of people. And threatened him.
Wow. Yeah.
And now she wasn't, asked, was she really going to call Sidney Korshak? She knew some other people too. Gavin De Becker is Carrie's, one of Carrie's best friends. They went to school together. She could call Gavin. Gavin knows a few folks. I mean, you know, it's like he had really met his match. And so she shut his butt down. So those are good Carrie stories. She had that thing about her. Don't mess with me. You know, she's like the Marine Corps thing. Don't tread on me. You know, that was Carrie's motto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you're right. I think that second to last Star Wars movie showed that gravitas, that that control that she had. Maybe she lacked it in her personal life through no fault of her own, but it certainly came across on the screen there, and it's great to hear those stories.
I'll tell you one thing that's very true about what you're seeing there on screen is, as much as Carrie was off the rails at times, she was also a person that never didn't show up to the set. He was, you know, she was a professional to her core. Now, that was something my mother handed down to us very young. She was a person that could be counted on. If there was a battle to be fought, she would rise to the occasion. She was, you know, always did. And so she, no shrinking violet there, you know, like a lot of people would. First of all, anybody that could overcome what she overcame in life and create the amazing amount of art that she was able to create across the spectrum is remarkable. It is a truly inspiring thing. It's more inspiring even than my mother and Molly Brown and all the things my mother overcame. My mother overcame a major adversity, but did so without the additional burden of mental illness. Mm-hmm. So Carrie did all that in the face of mental illness. That is truly an inspiring thing for all of us to see, that we could do those things. You remember she said, turn your pain into art. Remember Meryl at the Academy Awards at the end paid tribute to Carrie? She said,
absolutely.
My little princess said, turn your pain into art. Isn't that a great message to people that are hurting right now or at any time? You know, is to turn to art as the answer. And that is what, you know, we were trained. That's a Debbie thing. You know, we were both trained and raised by my mom. And there is, there's echoes of that throughout her life.
Yeah. And I know a big part of that, you saying that your grandpa drilled into your mom that, you know, I can't doesn't exist in this family. And that seems to be something you all have carried on.
Yeah. Well, nobody knew where it came from. And I'm, by the way, I don't know where it came from before that, but I do know that there is no word in our vocabulary, can't, in this family. It did come from my grandfather. I tell the story in my book, but I didn't realize that he had programmed my uncle and my mother, my sister. He had programmed us all, you know, with that mantra. And that is what allowed, maybe allowed us to, you know, to do some of the things we did, because we were just fearless. We didn't realize that we couldn't do it. Sometimes if you're not afraid of something and you just do it, before you know it, it's done. And you don't, fear is the biggest killer of creativity and of getting things done.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were kind of braised to have no fear. You could see that in her.
Absolutely.
In both Carrie and Debbie.
Todd, you're in this wonderful room, and you mentioned it earlier that you're going to use this for a live stream. Is that correct?
Yeah. So there's the room. You can see it. And so Kat sits in the other chair over there. My wife, Catherine Hicklin, she was a soap opera star for decades, and she has a pretty decent following. So we do a Facebook Live blog, or whatever you want to call it, off of her Facebook page. So Catherine Hicklin's web Facebook page is where we stream from. We do it Monday, right, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And we do really cool giveaways. Some remarkable things are given away, including Hollywood collectibles. And then we also auction things off that are a little bit more serious in the collectible area. And those things, the money for that is used to support local charities, including animal funds, and the Las Vegas Police Department, things like that. So and other little things that we do. We are, what's cool about this, that I have a message that I always use on that show, which is that we are all at our own unique place on this earth. And only we can see certain things that are going on. The government can't see your neighbor's problems or needs or something that's going on in your little world. And so if you, all of us are these ambassadors to be able to see problems, and we can all do something to fix those little problems. And so that's kind of what we do. What we see, we try to fix. Like a very small example is we had a guy that was working for us on an air conditioning crew, and he was a veteran, and he was literally living in horrible conditions. He had, and that's terrible just to think of that. But his daughter was not being able to go to school, and in order to go to school even remotely, you had to have a laptop computer. So she couldn't even go to school here in Vegas. And I'm like, how stupid is the school district that it doesn't even have a computer for all these kids if you're going to make them all stay home? And the ones that can't afford it need to be given computers. Anyway, so we obviously did a fund and gave computers to these children. And that's the kind of thing that we try to do with that, the benefits for those shows. And I give away some of my mother's good stuff. I mean, we find things that are collectible and sometimes high-end things. You know, like tonight we're doing... I Hit the Deck, which is not the best MGM musical, but it's pretty impressive. We're giving away, now Warner Brothers is one of our sponsors, the Time Warner Film Library, so they give us DVDs. So we always give DVDs away of Debbie movies, Blu-rays and other things, which is wonderful of them. So they're one of our sponsors. So we always package DVDs up with these gifts. So I had a signed Hit the Deck album signed by my mother.
Oh, wow.
And so you got the front album cover, it's framed, it was on the walls at Debbie Reynolds Dance Studios, and then so you get a signed Debbie thing, and then it comes with the Blu-ray DVD. So that's not earth-shaking, but it's a great collectible, and it comes you know, from Debbie's collection. And so I have enough of that stuff that I can, you know, share it with her fans. We auctioned off a Molly Brown script, an original Unsinkable Molly Brown script that Debbie had used on the set. Now, I happen to have had three of them because she had used three, because you have one at home, one on the set, blah, blah, blah. So I took one of those and I auctioned it off. But before I auctioned it, I said, please do not bid on this if you're going to put this on eBay or anything else. If you're not going to keep this in your home because you are passionate about this film for you, don't bid on it, please. I'd rather not get as much money. I want someone who really digs it. So the girl that ended up winning it, you know, is a huge fan of my mom's. But more importantly, she has an incredible story that the Unsinkable Molly Brown movie did for her in her life, inspired her. And so she wanted that script. And she doesn't have a ton of money, this girl. So she really spent what is a lot of money, you know, to have that script. So it's important that these things go to the right place, because you don't, I mean, how many Molly Brown scripts are there with an original MGM serial numbered script cover, you know, with it's rare.
Yeah,
and, you know, I can't hoard. How much of this stuff can I have? You know, I actually have, you know, I have a 10,000 square foot warehouse and then some. So it gives you some idea of the depth and breadth. It will take me years to even give it all away. So I'm going to give away the lesser things. And that's kind of what we've started to do, and it's fun. I don't know if I have stuff sitting here that we've been giving away. But like I said, we take, like, you know, I have great posters and lobby cards, and we give away those things, and then we give away DVDs with them. And, you know, people like it. So there's a mixture of things. There's some that we just straight up give away. You know, we don't even – it's just – if you we do trivia, film trivia, and things that are generational trivia, you know, about the times. So we have a lot of fun giving this stuff away. And it also entertains people when you know, do trivia. They love trivia. And you could see on this, I'll go to the, see if I can see it over here. You can't quite see it. On the wide side, you can see it. Sort of. This thing over here, this is one of our drawing things. You know, it's the.
Like a little bingo raffle. Yeah.
Exactly. So we literally bought that at another auction so we could have a bingo kind of drawing for people. You know, I mean, don't expect to see, Carrie's blaster. But now, here's a cool item that we found that we brought up. These were in our warehouse. These are commemorative stamps from Star Wars.
Oh, wow.
And I've seen a few of these around, but I had not, they're all upside down. I'd seen this one on eBay, in fact. It's the stamp from like 2007, whatever that release was. Well, we found all 14 of them.
Wow.
Here's the good one. But they're all here, like 14 of them or 17 or something. So we put these up because I found a number of sets of those. So we're using those in both the giveaway and in the auctions, and it works great. I mean, how many sets do I need? No, I mean, you know, it's like at a certain point, I look at something and I say, okay, I have one ruby slipper. I have one of the, like I would never sell this. Like, and yet it has no significant value. But Terry gave it to me. So I think that's a something that you don't sell. But on the other hand,
I realized that's, that you have a lot of. That's kind of an ugly baby Yoda is what that is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it depends on your point of view. The new baby Yoda, now this looks like more of a Jewish baby Yoda.
All right.
It looks like
I could concede that, sure.
I mean, anyway, I don't
know. Yeah, it looks like Larry David a little bit.
when you're a collector, and I think collecting right now is a great thing. I do encourage people to collect because even if you don't have huge amounts of money, you can find small things to collect that are not stupid money. I like collecting. It's a fun thing to keep yourself occupied, especially right now where a lot of people are spending a lot of time at home. You know, you could search the internet and search auctions and find little collectibles and try to put a set of things together. I mean, you know, like people could spend like years trying to find all of these to get them framed and just make that collection happen. And that's a fun thing to do. So I encourage people to find your passion, whether it's salt shakers or Marilyn Monroe costumes, find your thing. My mother started me very young on collecting things when I was a little boy. So I'm very, I just gravitate towards it. I love a Sunday afternoon with Turner Classic movies on in the background and eBay or something in front of me. And I just randomly look for stuff, you know, and I still buy Debbie stuff. I buy pictures. I'll give you a great collectible story. Now this is a great story, and I would show you this painting if I had it near me, but I'm always searching for Debbie items. And so there was an auction that came up where this artist had said, a famous clown artist, it was an oil painting, and it was in an art auction, and this was going to go for a few thousand dollars, but the artist felt that this was potentially a painting of Debbie and Eddie Fisher, but he couldn't tell, he didn't know for sure. But the artist had claimed that, but the artist was dead. But so I saw that like listed on a catalog, and I looked at the picture and bam, immediately I said, I know that painting that was hanging on my father's wall at his house on Beverly Estates Drive in Beverly Hills when I was a little boy. I remember it, but I had no evidence. So I said, I know it's true. I'm going to buy the painting. So I, in faith, I just bought the painting at that auction. Painting came, and I knew immediately it was my mom and dad, but again, I had no evidence that it was anywhere. 2 years later, while searching on eBay, there's a picture of my father sitting on his bed, and over his shoulder is that painting. So how much is that picture worth to me that I just found on eBay? I don't know, I paid $20 for it or whatever. But that's what I mean about collecting. Collecting leads to other things. Collecting leads to this sort of bottomless pit of surfing and chaining and looking for things. And there's all sort. This leads to that, and that leads to this. It's a lot of fun, and I think it's a great way to keep yourself amused during these strange times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Todd, we are slowly running out of time here, but we thank you so much. Just a couple final questions. What do you want people most to remember about your mother and your sister?
Well, you know, they were both inspiring, strong, creative forces. And I would want people to remember the great art that they created, the laughs that they generated. Nobody generated more laughs than Carrie, not even my mother, who was a remarkable comedian. But Carrie's quotes are amazing. She left behind as many quotes as Winston Churchill. And I mean, you have to believe that that is an amazing accomplishment. So I'm so proud of their lifetime achievement in the arts, in the entertaining of all of us. And we were all observers of this remarkable talent, and it always would show itself in different ways. And Carrie went from, you know, a small, I have her costume in my home here, her first Vegas costume. She went from that to wanting to sing on stage. And then she went into my mom's play, Irene. And then she did a little movie called Shampoo. And then that little movie Shampoo led to a little audition for George Lucas that led to the Star Wars thing. And there's just, and then that led to eventually to her writing books. And that had led to her doing speeches and doing all these amazing quotes. So the chain of creativity never ended, and my mother started it, and they were remarkable women. I mean, remarkable. I mean, there's a lot of remarkable people in their respective areas. I mean, you know, there's just an endless line of great women, but these two, I had a front row seat to observe, and they were so much fun to watch and to grow up with, and to be in their lives, and to see so many people inspired by them. It's a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Todd, we thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you on again at some point, just to hear more Hollywood stories.
Well, I'd say Hollywood stories told here. I'll have a shingle ready next time.
Absolutely.
We'll look for it.
Yeah, you can go anywhere. You know, it's like there's like no end to it all.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Todd.
All right. Great to have you guys. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. And wow, what an interview. Todd, you know, Todd's got a million stories, I think, Eric.
We could have gone another hour. He would have given us even more stories. Very, very generous of him to give us that time and those wonderful stories for our little podcast.
Yeah, and he's not afraid to give his opinion on anything. He's not afraid to let you know what he's thinking. But yeah, it's a very generous. We hope to have him on again at some point, because we could go another four or five podcasts just his stories. One of the things that I wish I had talked to him about, we just didn't have time. I wanted him to tell us the story about him walking in on Betty Davis on the toilet when he was like 8 years old.
So if you want to read that story, we suggest go get his book, My Girls. It's been out for a couple of years, but it's still available wherever you get your books. And go check out the video version of this, because there's a real visual component to this interview. So this will be posted on our YouTube site. And then follow our feed and give us some feedback on Facebook, and tell us what else you want us to cover.
Yeah. He also mentions in the interview, the documentary Bright Lights that came out right after they passed away, and that, I watched it, and it is a must see. It's on HBO Max right now, if you're a subscriber, and you can also get it through Amazon Prime. And, you know, just serendipitous how that Carrie and him planned to do this kind of as a tribute to their mother, you know, as she was kind of in her waning years, and ended up being a poignant look at a mother-daughter relationship, you know, and because it was released right after the two of them passed away. So it's amazing how things in his life, if you read this book, things in his life just sort of tend to work out that way.
Yeah, and there's amazing serendipity throughout his whole life.
Yeah, so we, once again, you know, Todd, if you're listening, we thank you so much for this. We hope to have you on again, and just get more of your perspective and more of your stories. And as Eric mentioned, we do have a new Front Row Classics feed that you have to subscribe, because we are going to be doing some feed-only episodes here. This episode that we're doing will be on our Front Row main feed, so all of our Front Row listeners will be able to listen to it. But we recorded an episode last month on Road to Morocco that was very fun, and if you want to listen to that, please subscribe to our feed anywhere where you can get podcasts. Just look up Front Row Classics and you'll find us. And we got quite a bit coming up. Eric, do you want to give a preview of what we have coming up for Front Row Monster Cast next month?
Yeah, so the month of October, we always do something related to the horror genre, and we picked two of them this time. So the first movie that we are going to discuss is And I don't remember the year that this one came out, and it's sort of a companion piece to the one we did last October, which was Dracula. And this year we decided to tackle the classic monster movie, Frankenstein. So we're going to do that. And then immediately after that, we're going to record another episode, which will be Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I think I got that title correct, but it's an Abbott and Costello. And they did a couple of those movies where they met some movie monsters. This is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. So a little lighter take too.
Yeah, so October is a big month for us at the Front Row, a lot of different content. I know the Frankenstein episode will definitely be on the main feed. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein might be a feed-only episode for us. So that's a popular title. So if you want to listen to that, make sure once again to subscribe to our Front Row Classics feed-only podcast. So yeah, but a lot of stuff coming up, a lot of great stuff coming up here in the fall and winter. And We just keep on going, and hopefully we'll close out 2020 strong, and hopefully look forward to a bright 2021.
Yeah, hopefully we can get back out and interact with people. Until then, keep watching these classic movies.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So as we close out this special episode of Front Row Classics, I am Brandon Davis.
And I'm Eric Flick.
And we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.